Welcome to Human Risk, a podcast dedicated to the understanding of human behaviour as a risk. Here's your host, Christian Hunt.
Hello and welcome back to a very special edition of the Human Risk podcast. Now, normally when I interview guests on the show, it's something that we book sometime in advance. This show is slightly different. It came about when I saw a photograph of a doctor lying on the floor next to a series of forms that stretched out well beyond the length of his body. It was used to illustrate an article that talked about bureaucracy in the NHS. For non-UK listeners, that's short for National Health Service, which provides free healthcare to anyone ordinarily resident in the UK. The point the doctor was making with his photograph, which was taken in 2019 but only went viral recently, was that he was spending far more time filling in forms than providing medical care to his patients. I posted the photograph and a link to the article on LinkedIn, and it generated a huge response. So I thought I'd approach the person in the photograph to see if he'd be willing to appear on the show. I'm delighted to say that he did, and so on this episode I'm speaking to Dr. Gordon Caldwell. Gordon was a consultant physician and clinical lead, he's now retired, and he's worked in various hospitals across the UK. In our discussion, I asked Gordon how the photograph came about. There's a link to that and the LinkedIn discussion in the show notes, and we explore the topic of bureaucracy in the NHS. As you'll hear, he's a passionate advocate for making healthcare less about bureaucracy and more about providing medical care. We explore some of the obstacles he's had to deal with and some of the research and work he's done to try and improve things. I think this is really interesting from a human risk perspective, because we've all been in situations where bureaucracy has overwhelmed us, either things we've had to do in the workplace, or situations where we've been confronted with someone trying to do something but being thwarted by paperwork. If we can learn about bureaucracy in larger organisations, there are lessons for all of us. One final pointer for people who are unfamiliar with the National Health Service, when Gordon talks about A&E, he's talking about accident and emergency. That's the UK equivalent of the emergency room, or ER, in the US. Before we get into this episode, my usual reminder that my new book, Humanising Rules, Bringing Behavioural Science to Ethics and Compliance, is available for pre-order. There are links to that in the show notes. With that said, please enjoy my discussion with Dr. Gordon Caldwell on medical bureaucracy. Gordon, welcome to the Human Risk Podcast.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here and have this opportunity to talk about something that fascinates me and keeps me driven, even though I've retired from the NHS. Thank you.
I'm absolutely thrilled to have you here. And before we dive into that, can you tell my listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I studied medicine 3 years in Oxford, 3 years at King's before I qualified as a doctor. I was always more interested in medicine than surgery, so being a physician, and went through training in King's in London, Brighton, Edinburgh, London again, Newcastle, and then became a consultant in Worthing in 1993, and I worked there till the beginning of 2018, moved up to the West Highlands and worked in a small hospital in Oban through till 2022 when I retired.
Wow, fantastic career. And the way that I came across you was I saw this picture that was splashed across a newspaper of you lying down in front of a sort of spread out set of forms. And it had been picked in the newspaper and it grabbed my attention because it was visually very, very arresting. And so I then put that on social media and it generated a huge amount of interest. So a fantastic piece of risk communication, because you really got a message across very, very vividly and very, very quickly. Let's talk about what prompted you to do that, because I think it's a really, really powerful intervention, but it's not immediately obvious that a doctor would be doing that. What drove you to do it?
Yeah, well, I'm a consultant physician and my specialty was diabetes and endocrinology. Particularly in diabetes, I've always worked very closely with nursing staff, with diabetes nurse specialists, and increasingly over the last 3 decades, work at the bedside is multidisciplinary working particularly closely with the nurses, because we have to cooperate together to fix the patient's problems. And I became interested that the nurses were always complaining about the amount of paperwork they had to fill in, that this was detracting from their ability to look after patients. And around about 2007, 2009, began to get interested in lean processes and cutting out waste and making sure you're not wasting people's time. And the nurses, I say, were constantly complaining of having to fill in too much paperwork rather than actually getting on and doing the work. And also I had the problem that there's so much paperwork, I couldn't find the bit of information I wanted, like the patient's weight, for example. And through a lot of work on Twitter, I knew that there were people, nurses having to fill in like 32-page booklets when a patient arrived on the ward. And one day I just said to the charge nurse on our ward, could she give me one copy of every piece of paper that would have to be completed by a nurse who was admitting a patient with diabetes who needed to have intravenous antibiotics. Maybe they got an infection in their foot. So she provided me with all those, and I went back to my office and thought, I'll just lay them down on the floor and take a photo to show what they're like. And at that moment, Lindsay, my secretary, came in, and she had this brilliant idea. Why don't you just lie down next to them, Gordon? And I'll take this pot shot off you. And then we turned all the pieces of paper over again because they're two-sided. And I put that on Twitter in November 2019, shortly before the pandemic. Of course, notified all the people in Highland where I was working about what I saw as just a too much paperwork. So the whatever information in there was of value was difficult to find. And it took so much time that the nurses couldn't get on and look after the patient. Maybe they couldn't give the intravenous antibiotic because they're putting in paperwork. So that's how it came about, and put it out in 2019. And I really don't have any idea why about 3 weeks ago it suddenly took off. I mean, it generated a lot of interest in 2019 and was definitely the single tweet that had had the most interaction that I'd ever had, but nothing like what's happened about 3 weeks ago.
And so, it's literally a sort of viral experience that just out of nowhere. And so, So the first you become, are people getting in touch with you? People, how did you find out that it had sort of picked up again?
I don't know. There's somebody who, I don't know, a guy called Dr. Armitage, who he retweeted it or something. And for some reason, it took off. And at one stage, a couple of weeks ago, it was the most prevalent tweet in the Netherlands for some reason. And I think possibly the other aspect of it is that because I'd retired from the NHS, I was much freer to speak out about the systems and the criticisms of it, and not have to feel that I'm letting my organisation down by speaking out about it. So I think that was part of being able to then promote it that bit more than perhaps previously.
And obviously, with the NHS being in the headlines at the moment in terms of funding and strikes, it feels like a picture of the moment as people are talking about a health service that's under huge amounts of pressure.
Yeah.
You've beautifully encapsulated one of the things that if you ask people sort of, you know, what are the problems, anybody that's experienced it would have a sense that bureaucracy might play a part. And so it's almost sort of feels like it could have been taken now, given the noise that's there. So the points you were making have still remained valid, but it feels like it's very, very, I guess, relevant for today.
Yes. I think it's particularly relevant today because both the government and the unions, the BMA, the RCN, are all saying the solution is more staff. But actually what you need is more staff time to look after patients. So if you're spending a lot of staff time doing stuff that's not looking after patients, let's throw that away. I think going back a long time in history, Xenophon took his army into Persia, got defeated, and had to run away as quickly as possible. So he threw everything away apart from the stuff they needed, a few weapons and some food, and ran back. So when you're under pressure, you've got to hold on to what's important, jettison as much as possible that is of no value, particularly if it's actually negative value, and then get on with doing the work that's necessary. The sort of example I would give of how much time can be lost in bureaucracy is falls in hospital. So we know that frail patients are susceptible to falls, and if they fall, they're likely to break part of their body. Now, an expert nurse can identify a frail patient literally in the blink of an eye and can see them tottering over towards the toilet. And what that person needs is somebody, a healthcare assistant or a nurse, or to take their arm, get them to the toilet without falling. But during the admission process, the nurse may be filling in 40 minutes of form filling, either on paper or on computer. And it's just as bad on computers, if not worse. So if she's filling in the paperwork, the patient may then totter off to the toilet, fall, and fracture their femur. So once the patient is then transferred to orthopedics, she has to fill in the fact the patient fell, obviously. They have to get the whole nursing team together to discuss why the fall happened. Then they have to fill in a Datix form, which involves 5 screens of information, which goes off to the risk management team, who have committee meetings about why it all happened. The message comes back that, surprisingly, the nurses hadn't filled in the risk assessment forms properly. That must be why the patient fell. So they've got to learn to fill in all the assessments. The relatives take legal action against the case. That involves a whole lot more expenditure and time. And the evidence is then that the nursing staff really weren't doing their job properly because the paperwork wasn't filled in properly. So if they can't even fill in the paperwork, they obviously weren't looking after the patient properly. But what we know from all the studies of falls is that it relates to frailty and understaffing. So you can identify frailty in half a second, and the understaffing is what you need to deal with. And yet you've got all that massive bureaucracy, which can cause huge expense and take the staff away from the patients even more than just saying, yes, this patient's frail, they're likely to fall, they're going to be a nutrition risk, they're going to be a pressure area risk, and they're probably going to be a complex discharge needing social care. I know expert nurses can identify that certainly within 5 minutes, but they're taking 40 minutes to document it. Then the documentation, when you pick it up, you can't understand it because it doesn't just say, this person's frail, is going to fall over, needs good food, and is going to take a long time to discharge.
Wow. And so one of the interesting things when I posted the picture and the response I got on LinkedIn when I posted, in the same way that everybody became a virologist during COVID, and we sort of, you know, people had seen, people are military experts, given what's going on in Ukraine, we suddenly had a lot of people, some of whom, to be fair, did have some relevant experience, but lots of people sort of opining on what they could see. And so there was a natural presumption that either this was an exaggerated case, actually, that it wasn't as bad as it looks. How much of that would you say, that in terms of the sort of Gordon length and a bit of paperwork, how much of that is actually necessary and how much of that is repeat? You know, what sort of information is on there? Is this highly repetitive? What's there?
Well, let me first say that that's just the nursing paperwork. There'd be doctor's paperwork on top of that, and the physiotherapists and the occupational therapists and the social workers and the pharmacists would all also have this. And within that, there's massive overduplication, and it's all being done manually. It's either handwriting or retyping stuff that's on a computer system. So the possibility of generating errors there, so the patients, they might have the weight in 6 places, 4 entries.
Right, because logically, every single piece of paper is going to have their name on it and identifying data. So that's a chunk of it.
Yeah, and that will either be a label stuck onto it or the nurse writing it by hand. Those forms are not coming off a computer system with all that demographics on it already. But what's happened, so taking it more, concentrating back again on the nursing side. So I said I worked with specialist nurses. So there'll be a specialist nurse who's interested in nutrition, or the dietitian will be interested in nutrition. There'll be a specialist nurse for falls, a specialist nurse for pressure area care, and the pressure as a specialist nurse for delirium and dementia. Now, when problems arose previously, the answer would be, well, we're going to develop a form which will make sure that that's sorted out. So the pressure area nurse would produce something called the Waterlow Pressure Risk Assessment. And within that would be the height and the weight and the body mass index, the patient's medical conditions and other parameters to work out whether they need pressure relieving mattress. But then the dietitian also wants the height and the weight and the body mass index. So it's all being duplicated and reduplicated and reduplicated. And also it tends to be that every point is ticked. So another example I'd give would be that I was asked to look at a computer form for somebody having a catheter put into their bladder. And that had 140 data fields on it, but didn't have the two important ones that I was interested in, two of the really important ones I was interested in. Why did you put it in? Did you put it in because the man couldn't pee because he got prostate trouble? Or did you put it in because he was in kidney failure and you wanted to know how much urine was coming out? And it didn't tell you how much urine was in the bladder when you put the catheter in. So, but the 140 points were things, you know, did you wash your hands? Did you clean the perineum? Did you do this? So actually what you need is a standard operating procedure, which the nurses are trained in, the doctors are trained in. This is the way we put catheters in our hospital, preferably on a nice big visual A3 thing that you could clip on the side of the trolley and look at it whilst you're doing it. And then you're just saying, nurse so-and-so, put the catheter in following our standard operating procedure. Because, of course, nobody's going to say they didn't do the standard operating procedure. So the 140 points is irrelevant. And then the crucial information, what time did you put it in? What date and time did you put it in? Who are you? What size of catheter did you put in? Why did you put it in? What was the residual volume? And any other free text. You know, we put it in because they're in kidney failure. We want to know how much urine to produce every hour. Or we put it in because the guy was in retention. We're going to refer him to urology tomorrow. So I think what's happened is that we haven't realized the value of a standard operating procedure, of making sure people are trained in it, making sure the kit's there. And then, of course, you should have occasional random sort of audits, which it used to be what Sister did. She prowled the ward, checking that her staff were doing things the proper way. And if they weren't, she'd say, this is the way you should do it. If they didn't comply with that, you get them retrained or whatever. So you've replaced, because Sister's, of course, now away in the office filling in all the forms.
Right.
And not prowling the floor, making sure that the standards are kept. So by adopting a process where you have a standard operating procedure, good training, simply record the vital information that's important, and then some random audits to make sure that people are up to standards with good retraining, then you cut down a huge amount of this paperwork and free that time for the staff to do the thing. So like the falls risk assessment, what really matters is there a nurse and a healthcare assistant in the six-bedded bay as much as possible so they can have their eyes open when the old lady gets up to totter to the toilet and help her so she doesn't fall.
And so really, your point isn't, and I think this is obvious, but this is that your point isn't that we shouldn't have documentation. Right? We need an audit trail, but it's just that it's the volume of it. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me a little bit like, as often the case, it's sort of, well, we need the thing for this and the thing for this and the thing for this. And so sort of on a standalone basis, you might be able to justify each piece of paper.
Yes.
And each little, so it's not sort of somebody's going, how do I make this as bureaucratic as possible? But the net result is that these extra things get added on. And so what could be a very simple process has suddenly been rendered incredibly complicated and duplicative. Just because it's built up over time and has got worse, as opposed to nobody started out and said, this is a good way to do it.
No. I think I can remember when I started as a consultant, I used to hate the medical records committee because I'd want to have the information arranged in some way that I'd want. And I'd trial a form and I'd try it on my ward rounds and know that it was doing exactly what I wanted and say, okay, can we make this an official document, please? And they all said no, of course. And now, at some stage, the medical records committee lost their power and anarchy prevailed, and anybody can produce a piece of paper. And particularly if they're coming from a sort of higher up in the hierarchy, they can just impose it. And this happens, and this is what you've got to fill in as from tomorrow. And then you just got to get on and do it, or else you're a bad member of staff. So nobody ever set out with the intention of creating this mess. And every form has got a good thing, something reasonable behind it. You know, if a patient's going to go for major pelvic floor surgery, they've got to have venous thromboembolism prophylaxis to make sure they don't get a deep vein thrombosis and a pulmonary embolism. So yes, you've got to have that. But I don't think it needs to be an A4 sheet with 30 or 40 tick boxes in it. Particularly when you only need one indication to get it and one contraindication to not get it. So why do you have 40 tick boxes? So no, everything's got a reason behind it, but they've come up eventually with now this position where it almost brings care to stagnation. And that affects every single patient who goes to the front door of a hospital and leaves the front door of the hospital. And every step of the way is slowed down by this. And I'm worried that trusts are getting away with saying the problem is lack of social care. Because only a very small number of patients end up as delayed discharges, and probably 95% of patients walk out of hospital themselves. Now, if we could reduce each of those patients' length of stay just by 4 hours, we'd be creating beds in the morning before that day's admissions arrived. So you wouldn't have queues in A&E. or as big queues in A&E. You wouldn't have as big queues waiting for everything to happen. So if we polished up all these processes and made them lean, properly lean, then I think we could actually improve patient safety because the information would be visible and understandable. And we'd be releasing doctors and nurses and pharmacists' time to be with the patients doing the stuff that makes a difference.
And it seems to me that this is a classic sort of case of, pun not really intended, but sort of backside covering. And driven by, I guess, sort of insurance and protection needs. So it's driven not from a medical priority, but it's a bureaucratic documentation. It's almost looking and saying, well, if we get sued or there's a problem, we want to make sure all our paperwork is in order.
Yeah, there's definitely that thinking. And I worry that we've probably got two or three generations of nurses who have never worked in the circumstance where we don't have all this documentation. And as I say, actually the documentation ends up being self-defeating because if you make it so long that the nurse can't complete it properly within the time frame, because we've got to work quicker than diseases progress. If we don't work as quick as the disease overtakes us and the patient suffers. It's just slows everything down. And if we can get the 95% of independent patients out of hospital quicker, then the follow-on from that is there will be less queuing. There has to be less queuing. If you can get the patients through A&E instead of 2 hours, 59 minutes, you'll inevitably have fewer people hanging around waiting to be seen. And similarly, at the other end, if we can get somebody out of the hospital at 11 o'clock instead of 12 o'clock, that makes a big difference to moving somebody out of the acute medical unit up to the wards and seen by that team that day instead of 8 or 9 o'clock at night where nobody sees them until the following day.
And logically, and you've sort of touched on this, the solution to this problem isn't to digitize. I mean, you mentioned that there is the computer system is there, but I'm guessing if you've got a terrible paper process, the fact that you're sat in front of a keyboard as opposed to just filling it in with a pen doesn't really help.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thing about the computerization. I think there is the assumption, first of all, that the forms we've got at the moment are okay. Therefore, it's fine if you computerize them. And I would say unless you do the work, lean work, before you computerize, you'll end up with an even bigger mess, which happens to look quite neat inside a computer screen. And you actually lose that physical impact of, oh, there are 30 sheets of paper because you can't see it. But computerization obviously lends itself to resolving a whole lot of those problems. If the weight has to appear in six places, then you just put it in once and make it appear in six places as long as it's date and time stamped and you know who did it. Well, that's dead easy in a computer. So computerization eventually has to be the answer to this. But before you computerize, I think you've got to really rationalize what these forms are for, how you can arrange them, what the crucial information is the whole habit of documenting everything in that detail necessary. Again, I don't think it was in the Telegraph article, but in the Spectator article, I used the analogy of when I go to a motorway service station and go to the toilets, I can see immediately who cleaned the whole facility, when it was cleaned, when it's due for the next clean, and who to contact if there's a problem. And now I think if the NHS was suddenly commissioned with running motorway service stations, in each cubicle you went into, it would say, did you open the door? Tick. Yes. Did you lift up the toilet lid? Yes. Did you put the toilet brush into this? And by the time the hour had gone by, of course, the facility wouldn't be cleaned. And then they'd say, why it's not being cleaned? Well, you can see because the cleaner's not filling in the boxes. Well, no, the problem is the cleaner's not cleaning the toilet. And then, so the standard is maintained by the cleaner, obviously has good equipment, standard operating procedure, and the service station manager will come in every two or three times a day and just check that it's all being done. So we've got this belief that it needs to be documented in great detail or it wasn't done. And I think we've created that problem ourselves. I don't think that would sit with lawyers. If we said the correct way to record a falls risk is, yes, this patient is at falls risk, sign so-and-so, then they'll take that because that's the standard procedure. But what happens is they go to the director of nursing and say, what's the standard procedure for a falls risk assessment? So it's this document, 4 pages long, which every bit has to be filled in. So of course they believe them, and then you're showing that you're not doing it properly. So there's a whole lot of this thinking of mine, again, came from Atul Gawande, who developed the World Health Organization Operating Theatre Checklist. And I was developing a checklist for ward rounds to make sure we hadn't missed the important stuff, like has the person got a catheter in the bladder which should be taken out? So when I contacted him, his only comment was, don't introduce any change that slows the necessary pace of clinical care and use natural breaks for your checklist. So you can introduce a change that makes a little bit longer, something a little bit longer if you buy the time back somewhere else. But I can tell you that nobody but nobody other than me in my 42 years in the NHS ever used a stopwatch or worked out how much time anything took. So all these forms have been introduced by, often by well-meaning specialist nurses, and it's, the usual phrase is, it only takes a minute. Well, you've seen there's 60 sides of paper, so that's 60 minutes. And that's the time when the patient needed the antibiotic for their foot infection.
When you talk about it, and before we were recording, you mentioned Toyota as a good example of, mm-hmm. of sort of looking, if we looked at other contexts, and the toilets is a really, really well-made example, but if I took an extreme example of sort of the way an Amazon warehouse is run, there's a lot of attention focused on how quickly things are done, and it's possibly, it's gone too far the other way. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be something, if I look at the basics of what you're describing, if we thought about it, if we removed the medical context and the liability and we just said to ourselves, we need to run this process more efficiently, mm-hmm. some of the logic that's deployed in the private sector for making factories more efficient or warehouses more efficient or other processes, that's really what you're talking about here, mm-hmm. is to say, no, not to go to extremist where it's sort of like the focus is on throwing people out the door as quickly as possible. That would be counterproductive. No. But it's about, you're saying we should look at how long this is actually taking. And there are simple ways that we can do the important things more efficiently if we're not writing documents and stuff. So we should just look at this as a process that can be made a little bit more efficient or a lot more efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. No, when you're talking about that, many ideas, thoughts come to mind. So one of the things that is stressing the NHS at the moment is the large number of people in A&E departments who are waiting to see doctors and waiting for processes to happen. So when I was working in the small hospital in Oban, I had to go down to A&E because there were no A&E consultants there. And if we were under pressure, of course, I'd see some of the patients. And being a senior clinician, I could sometimes make a decision, assess the patient, examine the patient, make a decision that it's safe to discharge from the hospital. And that could take me 10 minutes. Now, when I'm talking about those forms, I'm talking about paper forms and computer forms. So if I'd seen the patient and decided they could go home after 10 minutes, I had to send a note to the GP. Understandably, say they came, I don't know, they had a sore thumb or something, maybe they ought to have a blood test for gout or something, over to you. I'd have to get into the computer system, get into a Windows 95 shell, launch a program called EDIS, which only had 5 licenses for the hospital, although there were more staff than that in A&E. And it was so counterintuitive that I'm an expert computer user. I still had to ask a nurse or a junior doctor every time I used that software how I found my patient in the software and how I did the letter. That could take easily 20 minutes just to say to the GP, the patient had a sore thumb, I think you ought to check them for gout. Now, of course, if in that system, if I'd had the laptop or an input device with the patient, my notes then should automatically go into the record, then at the end just hit send, or a message even for the patient, to the GP to have a hyperlink to the record. So if they're wanting to hit the 4-hour target, and I'm wanting to give the patient a good service, which would be a good service, and the GP a good quality service, all that stuff more than doubled the length of time it took to get for me to make the decision, which is a nonsense. And the other thought that came to my mind then, because you're talking about Amazon, so I buy nearly everything from Amazon because I'm in the remote part of the west coast of Scotland. So as soon as I'm buying it, they tell me they've got the order, They tell me where it's coming, where it's got to, when it's coming. And if I wanted to, I could know the name of the guy who's going to deliver it to me. If I order a CT scan to see if somebody's got cancer, I have to write the form on paper, by hand, myself, including all the relevant clinical details, which of course I've collected already because I've interviewed the patient. Send that piece of paper to the X-ray department. I get no confirmation it's been received, so I have to check their system the next day to make sure it's been received. I don't know when the scan's been done. I don't know whether it's been reported. I have to go and look for that all the time. So that's what you would understand as an order communication system. I have not worked in an NHS hospital in my 42 years that had an order communication system. It's all this sort of manual stuff. And at the best, even if it's all made electronic, they didn't have a way to push the result to me specifically or an important result. So you always at the end of it rely on the radiologist picking up the phone to you and saying, yes, the X-ray shows cancer, you better move things ahead. So I had a hope that before I retired, I'd have an electronic order comms system. I sat on a committee to commission an order comms system in 1995 for Worthing Hospital, and there was still no order comms in 2018 when I left. In Highland, they decided to upgrade to Office 365 rather than have an order comms system. And I said, I'd be happy to manage with carrier pigeons if I could have an order comms system to make it safe for me to ask for tests, know that they've been done, and get the results.
But I mean, what strikes me as you're talking is the disconnect between the medical practices and processes, i.e. the equipment that is available for you to undertake analysis and diagnosis. Yeah, we wouldn't be using equipment from the 1990s or 80s, or even possibly even before. If there was something more modern available, you'd be, well, let's get the latest tech. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be the absolute latest, but like it would be modern technology.
Yeah.
And yet for some reason, the back office, in simple terms, has not been updated at all. That's sort of example. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to be a very, I guess it's a logical thing because you want to be spending money on medical equipment as opposed to administrative equipment. But again, any other context, if I looked at the military, they would put high-tech equipment at the front line, but you would have the logistics to back that up.
Yeah, but when you say equipment, the medical record is equipment. The medical record is the patient. There's a brilliant 1975, I think, black and white video of Larry Weed addressing the doctors at Harvard about the importance of the medical record. And the patient is the medical record. So you've got to have a modern medical record that meets that function. But going back to your point about how has this arisen and why haven't we got all this modern technology? So we've got a modern medical record that supports the consultation, either in outpatients or on ward rounds. I think it goes back to Taichi Ono, who used to put his new recruits into a chalk circle in the middle of the workplace, and they had to stand there until they understood what the work was and they could identify waste. And they weren't allowed to get out of that circle. Now, for some reason that I've got some ideas why it happens, the people that we call managers in the NHS and the people we call leaders in the NHS, they may come to the workplace on glory visits and shake people's hands and see that people are busy, but they don't stand there and understand, get a deep understanding of what the process is and what it is we're actually doing. And I think to an extent they're actually frightened of it because doctors are smart, intelligent people who give them a hard time. We'll always give managers a hard time because we always want it to be better. And they're also quite possibly understandably frightened of patients because they look ill and they're horribly unwell and bad things are happening all around them. So in my career, I've certainly since 2007, I've endeavored to get as many executives, members and people outside of the hospital to come and watch my ward rounds and try and explain to them what's going on. And the smart ones just say, like we're saying, it's a chaotic mess. And how do you get people through it? How do they stay safe in this system? But that's not backed up then by them coming back and doing what Toyota would do. Let's understand the process. Now, to me as a doctor, the process is that I've got to make a diagnosis in the patients in the context of their current clinical and social health. I've got to make a management plan that will deal with those issues. And some of that management plan might be, I'm not going to deal with this now, but I'm going to make sure I follow it up in 2 months. Then you've got to implement that plan, give the person the antibiotics. Then you've got to monitor them to see if they make the progress I expect. And very few patients make exactly the progress you're going to expect because medicine is very complex and changeable and full of surprises. Then you've got to go back and review the progress and go around that circle again. So the product, what we're producing is a unique management plan for a unique patient with a unique outcome. So what do we need? What do I need to make a diagnosis? I need to have, preferably before I even clap my eyes on the patient, a summary of their previous medical conditions. I need to know what medications they're on. I need to have access to the clinical correspondence, which is full of rich synthesis from other professionals about what they think is right, wrong with the patient. They might be wrong, but at least it's their professional opinion. I need to be able to read that. I need to be able to look at all the results, then interview the patient in an unhurried manner, examine the patient, think about all of that, come to an idea of what I call a working diagnosis. So maybe they've got pneumonia in the context of emphysema and they're a smoker and they've got diabetes and a bit of prostate cancer as well, and then establish a management plan. Now, I think we as a profession have been really poor at explaining that to our IT systems analysts and our programmers. And for some reason, management haven't really seen that. That's what you're supporting. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to establish what's wrong with the patient, fix them, and make sure you're going the right direction. So this lack of analysis of what's happening at the front line is what's astounded me. And you know, you say this went viral 2 or 3 weeks ago. I've been working on the efficiency of ward round since at least 2004, and getting some help from some people, but really difficult to get a grasp on it. But if you go back, you know, there were publications in, I think, 2011 between the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of Nurses on best practice for ward rounds. Now, that came about through my work as well, through my interest. How can we get the team working together properly to fix patients?
And is this a UK or an NHS-specific thing? Is this something to... I mean, I recognise you haven't worked elsewhere, but to the extent, you know, is this particularly bad, or is this a sort of healthcare problem in other places?
I think to an extent it's an international problem. Yeah. In the States, they've had to connect their electronic clinical records with the administrative records for charging and so on. So then they're drowning in the process to first of all get permission to do the CT scan, then to charge for the CT scan. And certainly there's a lot of criticism from doctors in America. They can't see the wood from the trees because there's so much information. It's just overpowering and you can't do what doctors have to do, which is this very high level integrated thinking about what's wrong with the person. And you can't communicate that easily. So it is a problem, I think, all around the world, and how you document it and how you get the information so it appears in the format that we need it. Now, I think, again, you've talked earlier on, I think before we started the podcast, about other industries. And I don't think that we've really grasped the nettle at all in the health service about, it's very different writing stuff down on pieces of paper from interacting with a computer screen. So going back to, do you take the piece of paper and put it on screen? Almost certainly not, because the interaction between pieces of paper and the computer screen is different. So I suppose I'm almost saying, I'll go right back to the fundamentals. What is it we're trying to do? What are the priorities? How can we communicate in such a time-constrained business and stay safe? Yeah.
And that time-constrained piece, one of the things that always amazes me in the few times I've been in hospital has been the sort of, for obvious reasons, there's a sense of urgency. There's lots of sort of things moving quickly. And it always struck me as being a very pressured environment. And we know that in pressured environments, the human decision making is often suboptimal, right? For very obvious reasons. And I wondered how that played into the dynamics you're talking about.
What immediately came to my mind then was that BBC Two documentary on Camp Bastion in Afghanistan.
Oh, right.
and there were soldiers being brought in with their bodies blown to pieces who were holding on by a thread. There wasn't any sense of pressure, urgency, panic in that situation because everybody was thoroughly trained. They had good kit. They were communicating effectively. They weren't necessarily using computers. They were using whiteboards, whatever it was, the right whiteboards, whatever it was, so you could stay calm in the midst of chaos. And that has to be the objective, that you've got to be calm in the midst of chaos and free your mind to think, stand back a little bit. Now, if we're deluging nursing staff, particularly I think nursing staff get this deluge, and that you've got to do this or else you're not a good nurse, you're not doing the right stuff, you're creating anxiety because they know they're going to have to fill in all the paperwork. You know, if you've got a patient at 3 hours, 50 minutes, one of the reasons the nurse wants them through in 3 hours, 59 minutes is so she doesn't have to fill in the paperwork because you haven't got them out in 4 hours. It is very unbelievable for people outside medicine to understand that that nurse who's already been trying to get the patient through the system as quickly as possible for 4 hours, they get to 4 hours, 1 minute, is now going to have to fill in pages of information about why the person didn't get through in time. And the reason they didn't get through in time is because there's so much bureaucracy and the systems are so inefficient. And then you add to it by putting in more paperwork.
And it's always struck me that when you have sort of crappy bureaucratic processes that people recognize mm-hmm. as such, and you're under time pressure, the likelihood of you doing that, you know, completing them well, it becomes an exercise that you just sort of get through as quickly as you possibly can. Yes. And we all know this for, you know, simple example, right? We download a piece of software and we have those terms and conditions that we're supposed mm-hmm. to have theoretically
read. Yeah, just tick it off, yeah.
And then we just tick it off, right? Or we want to rent a car and there's about 20 signatures required before we can get the damn thing. I have no clue what I'm signing, but it'll be all right. I just want the car anyway. And so when I look at those sort of instances of, and that's not the same sort of pressure, but there is an element of, I want to get on with the next thing, the more important thing, mm-hmm. where we know that the ostensible purpose of that bureaucracy, it fails in the sense that we haven't read it, right? It passes the box ticking test, fails the have they read it, understood mm-hmm. it, taken this exercise particularly seriously test. And so it struck me that when you were talking about lots of these sort of processes to go through, it wouldn't be surprising if people sort of viewed that as being, you know, this isn't what I'm here to do, so I'm just going to do that quickly. So even if there's logic behind mm-hmm. the bureaucracy, it's not going to be necessarily done to the highest quality, which therefore almost in some cases would negate the purpose of having it in the first place.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. I was thinking, we talked earlier about pressure care. So somebody's old and frail and can't turn over easily in bed, they run the risk of getting a pressure sore. And as soon as you breach the skin, that's really serious and the patient will be in hospital for a long time and suffering a lot. So it's very, very important patients don't get pressure area damage. Now, when I was working in Worthing Hospital, they had a big initiative to cut down pressure damage and it worked. And the initiative had two parts. One was to reemphasize the Waterlow score. And the other was that if a nurse found a patient with a high score, she could then just pick up the phone and a private company would deliver the mattress within an hour. So this was very successful. And the nursing hierarchy said, look, that proves the value of the Waterlow score. And I said, but I've never seen the Waterlow score calculated correctly on the general wards, because one of the boxes says, does this patient have cardiac failure or respiratory failure, a major systems failure? Now, the nurses on our ward wouldn't tick that box because that's a medical diagnosis. Now, if they had respiratory or cardiac failure, it added a significant number to the score. So how was it that they reduced the amount of bed sores? Well, it's because, we go back to what I said earlier on, in a blink of an eye, the nurse knew that this person was at risk and now had a way to solve the problem, which was to phone the private company who brought the mattress in. So then the Waterlow score was almost being filled in retrospectively. The nurse knew that the patient needed a pressure mattress. So then she'd fix the Waterlow score so it came up with the right number.
Right, which is getting the right outcome. But it's
but why have all that bureaucracy process? When the Waterlow score is a very good training tool for a student nurse to learn about how you assess a patient. But in the same way that when you're with your driving instructor, they teach you all sorts of stuff, which then you become expert at it. You don't need to be reminded every time you get into the car to look in the mirror because you do it. And I think this tacit knowledge and professionalism of our nursing staff is being disregarded, and real major disregard for their professionalism. You know, if a nurse has worked in a general medical ward for 2 years, she can spot the patients who are frail, who are pressure risk, who are nutrition risk, and she shouldn't have to use all that detailed forms, and particularly this sort of backward cheating to get the outcome you wanted, but taking up a huge amount of time to get there. What do you need? She needs it. Ideally, the ward clerk makes the phone call and the mattress comes without the nurse having to make the phone call. We are very lost in all this. And, the BMA recently said that they thought that the badly designed computer systems were losing the equivalent of 5,200 doctors' time each day. So instead of having three new medical schools, you could just make the IT system work properly. I heard of one ward where they had taken this business seriously with the paperwork, where they culled the paperwork and found that they had generated 28 hours of nursing time per day. So that's one extra nurse on every shift. So if you've got three nurses on a shift, you're losing one of them in paperwork, which was unnecessary. Cut that down, you've suddenly got three nurses on the shift. It makes a big difference. Somebody can go for a break. Somebody can be in the bay watching the patient, make sure they don't fall. Somebody can be giving the antibiotics half an hour earlier.
It strikes me as you're talking, and particularly when you describe what for you is something you've done. So, you know, I'm sort of breathless when I hear you, and then I need to do this, and I need to do this, and I need to do that. I'm talking about the medical stuff as opposed to the form filling. Mm. The form filling, but I have a degree of familiarity with. But there's a lot you need to do. And so it's a cognitively demanding role.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that sort of occurred to me is that it's about freeing up people's time, but it seems to me it's also about freeing up people's cognitive capabilities and not Absolutely. Overloading them with crap, frankly. And sort of, and even it just sort of as I think it's not just the time you're taking away from people. It's also the, oh God, I've got to fill in that bloody form. And if I look at another context, which is nothing to do with medical, tax returns would be a good example. Mm-hmm. People put those things off because they don't enjoy them and they don't seem to add anything to the, unless you know you're getting money back, mm-hmm. which point there's a great incentive to fill it in. Otherwise, it's just like, oh, which is why loads of people do them mm-hmm. right before the deadline. And so it occurred to me that it's not just the time that's taken, but I presume it's not helping clear decision-making because you're thinking, I've got to do all this bloody paperwork as well.
I'll give an example on that. So again, I'd be down in, I was down in A&E in Oban one evening, and a frail patient had been brought in who lived alone, who'd had a fall, say, at 11 o'clock at night. Now you could say, I decided she was okay and she can go home and let's hope the carers are all right and they're in there in the morning. But I thought that was too much of a risk. But against that would be the thought, if I'm going to admit this patient, I've put all the information onto the emergency department of the information system, which doesn't connect with any other information system. So now I've got to rewrite it into another piece of information. I've got to write out all her meds. And I know that tomorrow morning, I'll then have to see, if I can, see her first thing in the morning, get her discharge done. And typing her meds into the discharge, that doesn't connect to anything else. So I've got to retype. And so, yes, it would weigh me against the idea of admitting the patient. And I could escape from that and think, I'm the consultant, I'll get the junior doctors to do it in the morning. But I hate giving other people jobs that I view as stupid. So I might well have given, in that case, given it to the junior doctor. But and then if I thought, well, I'd better just check that she's not anemic and that her kidneys are working properly, I'd have to write out all those forms and then chase all the results. And the whole thing is just horribly inefficient. But coming back to the cognition, so that picture was about forms. But actually what we're talking about is what are the processes for caring for patients. And the processes are very cognitively draining. So if I was on a ward round or in outpatients, I needed five separate pieces of clinical software open to be able to access the information I needed to make decisions about the patient. Now, that initially was on a tiny little laptop screen. And by the time I finished, it was a nice bigger laptop screen, but it was still only one screen. And so you're alt-tabbing between five or six applications just to find out the x-ray result, the blood test result, what medications the patient's on, what their previous clinic letter was. And then a lot of our patients went to Glasgow, get into the Glasgow system to find out where their consultant in Glasgow had sit. So all of my attention would be absorbed in alt-tabbing and trying to find the information, trying to get hold that in my brain for a few seconds whilst you make the decision. And then you say, well, it's crucial we look at the ECG. And ECG is a classic. Nobody knows where the ECG is, so they're everywhere and they're all out of order. So it's very much about the efficiency of the processes and the inefficiency of them. The consequence of that is you use up all your brain's cognitive power getting the information, whereas what computers are meant to do is augment my intelligence by supplying me with that information so that I can make the decisions. When I was finishing in Oban to do a four-hour outpatient, the day before I spent 2 hours developing a document in Word, which had all the crucial information I thought I needed for the consultation the next day, because I was going to have to, otherwise I'd have to juggle all this IT in front of the patient rather than consult with the patient. So by putting it onto a document, putting that document onto dual screens, the patient can look at one screen and say, I don't know why you say I'm on statin, doctor. I stopped taking that 5 years ago. Right, we'll take it off. So that gathering of the information was taking 2 hours, so I could then have my mind free to achieve something during the consultation. If we went back to 1975 and Larry Weed and the paper clinical record, actually all that stuff was just there and you knew where it was. It was nicely tabulated. You could find the stuff, you could access it. But we failed to produce an electronic version of that, and we put in all these different systems. So what you're actually trying to do with a patient, let's make a diagnosis and a management plan, becomes extremely difficult. And I'm sure there are times, I know there are times when I've missed a major important diagnosis in a patient because I was angry with the computer systems.
I mean, it seems to me that we, you know, doctors, nurses, you're humans. So you're going to get things wrong. Yeah. And that's, you know, of course we want to try and avoid that. But there are things are going to go wrong and they're going to be diagnosed, things are going to be missed. Yep. And so I mean, this is a really good example of, you know, where mistakes cost lives. And so we need to get this right. And so we really need to free people up. And it's a good example of how do we get the best out of the human brains that we have? And we're overloading them with absolute nonsense. So it seems like a really, if we think about sort of efficient processes, and treat the human brain as a machine, we're getting terrible return on investment in terms of where we if we thought of it as a computer, we're spending a ton of processing power and storage on things that don't seem to add any value.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's easy to find out how much a consultant costs the NHS per hour. You can go to just type in unit cost of health and social care and it tells you, which is of course much, much more than the salary I'm paid. So you can work out how much it costs the NHS per minute to employ me. So one of the things I invented was just a new ward round trolley for keeping the paper notes in. And when we did a cost-benefit analysis on that, it paid for itself in 5 days. Even though the trolley cost £1,000, it was releasing at least £1,000 worth of resource in 5 days. But I could never get the director of finance to see that that was a benefit. When finally they gave me dual screens in my outpatient facility, they only gave it because it came with a completely naff piece of software. You had two screens. I found that I could do 60 minutes work in 45 minutes. So that's a huge amount of money, professional time release. You got 15 minutes more work out of me every hour because you're giving me dual screens, which cost £200 each. They pay for themselves in 2 days. But could I get dual screens put into Oban Hospital? You had to shift heaven and earth to get dual screens put in. And then they didn't give them to the secretaries, and the secretaries are using five or six or even more pieces of software. And as soon as they got us the dual screens, this is fantastic. We can do so much more work. So this sort of even medium-term planning, financial planning, the value you get is me making diagnoses and treating people. I can do that quicker and safer with two screens, and you get your money back in 5 days. Carries no weight, seemingly, in the NHS. Well, talking about that, talked earlier about the patient who fell, fracturing their femur and all that. The cost of that is phenomenal. The fact that you didn't have enough nurses and healthcare assistants in the bay to help the tottering patient to the bed, to the toilet, would have cost probably £2 million by the end of that because of the harm that arose to the patient. Well, it could cost more.
And not to mention the psychological cost to them as an individual, right?
I wrote a paper on why can't we account for getting care correct first time in the NHS? Because you'd save in 5 years' time all those downstream costs. But you cannot get that put through. I don't know why. I've just read this week there was a patient in Ragmore Hospital in Inverness who died of head injury in hospital. And the nurses said they're understaffed. And management didn't manage to get the extra staff in to supervise the patient who fell out of bed, banged his head, and died. Now, the cost of that is absolutely phenomenal compared with the cost of an extra nurse. But what we're talking about today says you can have an extra nurse without actually employing an extra nurse. You just need to get rid of the horrible inefficiency and time wasting in the system. And then you've got the staff time that you need to look after patients.
I presume that if one were to ask your colleagues, former colleagues in the sense of people that are still working there, they would recognize what you're not a lone voice in the sense of the frustrations.
I think the difference with me is I don't give up. Most people just shrug their shoulders and say, we've fought against this for years. You'll never win. Why bother? I just want to get on and take the next gallbladder out. I'm not interested in dealing with all this stuff that means the patient doesn't get to my operating theater till half an hour later. When I've talked about, I realized when I got interested in Toyota and such like that I was starting to talk about lean, and you could see people just glaze over because lean is a management tool, and lean in the NHS experience means make more product with fewer staff and fewer facilities and don't cause any trouble. I then wrote a paper, just called it Clinically Lean, Cut the Crap. So if you go and speak to any doctor or any nurse and say, tell me the crap that stops you from doing what you want to do, it'll just flood out. Well, if you're somebody that I trust, it'll just flood out. You can't get them to stop. You ask the nurses, they say, it's all this bloody paperwork. I know the patient's a falls risk, a pressure area risk. It's going to be a slow discharge. Why do I have to spend 40 minutes documenting it? And then the next morning, when you ask me about how many times the carer comes in, I can't find it because it's buried in the paperwork. And it's probably wrong as well.
And so this is widely known about. And so really, you're just acting as a voice because you're unencumbered because you're no longer in it.
I've been interested in it for years, and I had Don Berwick, the international, probably the leading figure in patient safety in the world, came on my ward round in 2016 in Worthing. Professor Chris Hamm, the chief executive of the King's Fund, came on my ward round because of all this. And finally, Bruce Keogh came, the medical director of NHS England. Really nice guy, got on well with all my team and everything. We got to the third patient and he said, Gordon, is all this paperwork and computer work helping you? Because it seems to me it's hindering you. What struck me as astonishing about that is he was the medical director of NHS England and didn't know that. Yeah, I persevere. I'm passionate about it because even though I've retired from the NHS, I want, when I go into hospital, I want to get really good treatment on time. And I want the population of Britain to get that good treatment. And we're seeing it now. Patients are going into A&E. They can't get into A&E. So they miss the window for clot-busting drugs for a stroke. Or they miss their opportunity for a stent in their heart and going to cause years of trouble to their health. Now, we then have to do everything we can to speed those processes up and keep them safe. And there's so much going on in there that adds no value, and actually worse than adding no value, actually subtracts from care, even though the original intention was it's going to support care.
And so the fix, presumably from what you're saying, is it's not going to come from the ground up. It needs somebody in the government or in senior position to make it what might feel like a bold decision to scrap a load of things. But from your perspective, that's what it's going to take, right?
Yes. I mean, I think myself that it needs ideally the chief nursing officers, I think, in each of the four NHSs to acknowledge that it's gone out of control on the nursing side, the medical directors as well to acknowledge it's gone out of control on the medical side, and maybe to take one organization, one acute trust, put in a strong support team. I'm actually working now part-time for a NHS England Emergency Care Improvement Support Team. A team like that could really go into one organization and see if they can make this work. And it would need very strong leadership from the nursing, the director of nursing, the medical director, because they're going to be taking the risk that this philosophy that we've had for 30 or 40 years, that it's all got to be documented in this way. They've got to take the risk that you can discard that philosophy, go for a new approach, and stay as safe as the other hospitals. And I mean, if it's done properly, I have no doubt that they could actually make patient care safer and swifter and save money by doing that. But if it's a central diktat, you've got to sort all this out. It's going to be like all the other diktats. It will just add into the pile of stuff that never gets done.
I firstly want to say thank you. Well, one, for all the people that you've looked after over your career, because it's very clear. And I haven't come across a single medical professional that I've spoken to that hasn't spoken in the warm tones about looking after people. You don't go into that career without that. But it's very, very clear that you care, and that you care about this particular subject and the rationale behind it. And so I want to say on behalf of all those people that have benefited from your service, thank you. But I also want to say thank you for just what you're doing now, because I think it's a truth that needs to be spoken. And I think it's fascinating that you've got somebody that's been through this process that is recognizing that things can be better and is looking for I find it fascinating to look for parallels in other universes and say, actually, this is a huge, yeah, what you've talked about is something that you don't have to have. You wouldn't, I was going to say, don't have to step foot in the hospital. Most people have at some point, but you wouldn't, you don't have to be in the health service to recognize the dynamics you talk about. It's a human condition that bureaucracy thrives if it's allowed to thrive, and that more and more, and that it's a bad thing. And we all recognize that from other environments. And so I love the fact that you've looked outside and gone, we can do this better. And I want to wish you the best of luck with your mission, because it just seems to me incredibly important and incredibly obvious that we ought to be doing it, but it needs people to speak out.
Yeah, well, thank you. And as you can tell, if you wanted to interview me another five times, I'll be quite happy to do that and continue to talk about it and debate it. Because anything where you can get, I just think if we get one chief executive, one medical director, one director of nursing really to dig into that and get proper professional support, it could make such a difference. And once it's taken a hold in one place, would hopefully then spread.
Like a really good virus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gordon, thank you so much for all of that. You've been a fabulous guest on the show, and thank you very much for all the work that you do as well.
Okay, thank you too.
So that's it for this special episode of the Human Risk Podcast. My enormous thanks to Gordon for appearing, and to you for listening. To find out more about Gordon, to see the photograph that sparked this whole episode, and to read more about his views on bureaucracy and what can be done about it, have a look in the show notes. There are links to those there. If this is your first time listening to the Human Risk Podcast, welcome. You can subscribe wherever you get your quality audio content. It's available on all of the major podcasting platforms. Before I go, a brief reminder again that my new book, Humanizing Rules, Bringing Behavioral Science to Ethics and Compliance, is available for pre-order now. There's a link for that in the show notes as well. I'll be back very soon with another episode of this show. But in the meantime, steer clear of unnecessary bureaucracy, stay safe, and thank you so much for listening.